The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Finland and Sweden see this move to join NATO as a stabilizing factor in the Baltic Sea because it streamlines the defense planning of the whole region. And it is kind of also to show Russia that there are limits to its actions here, and that it can't go rogue in this region.
I'm David Preece, publisher of Lawfare, and this is the Lawfare podcast for July 19th, 2022. In recent weeks here on the podcast, we've brought you information and insight about Swedish and Finnish attitudes toward NATO membership and about Turkey's machinations regarding the two countries' applications. But now Sweden and Finland have been invited to NATO, and member country ratifications are coming in. So I thought it was a good time to dive a bit more deeply into what's happening with Sweden, Finland, and NATO. I sat down with Katarina Traksch, the director of the Stockholm Free World Forum and author of the book in Swedish, The Sea of Peace, Increased Tensions Around the Baltic Sea, and with Mina Olinder from the German Institute for International and Security Affairs, where she focuses on Finnish and Nordic security. We talked about Swedish and Finnish strategic perceptions and military interoperability with NATO equipment, about the geopolitical importance of the Baltic Sea, specifically the Gulf of Finland and Gotland, and about Swedish and Finnish risk perceptions as they await NATO membership. It's the Lawfare Podcast, July 19th, Swedish and Finnish security awaiting NATO membership. Let's start out by setting the scene about how Russia's invasion of Ukraine changed security perceptions in Sweden and Finland. And then we'll build on that to discuss what has happened in recent months. So first, Katarina, let's talk about this from the Swedish perspective. After many years of choosing not to align, suddenly, opinion polls changed, the government changed, and there was rapid movement, all because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, even though Sweden does not border Russia. Explain how that happened in Sweden.
Well, Sweden does not border Russia, but we have a long history that contains several wars with Russia throughout the centuries. Mm-hmm. So if you look at sort of arch enemies in our region, most Swedes consider Russia to be the arch enemy, even though historically, I would say that Denmark has rather been the arch enemy. We have fought more wars with Denmark, but throughout the years, Russia is close there in the top for that position.
And did the Russian invasion of Ukraine reveal something to Swedish, the general public and the government about Russian intentions that made it more important to seek membership in NATO?
Indeed it did. I mean, actually already in 2014 and for some already in 2008 when Russia invaded Georgia, sort of public opinion started to shift. People became more wary of Russia. Politicians spoke more openly about the risks of Russian aggression, and we started to change our defense policy that had for decades been focused on cutdowns and on minimizing the defense, and more specifically minimizing the territorial defense of Sweden. And that started to shift after 2014, but slowly. Like in many countries in Europe, Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea was not taken seriously enough, I would argue. But with the open aggression towards Ukraine, the open invasion of Ukraine in February this year, it became impossible to ignore. And it suddenly became pretty obvious that Sweden's former security policy would be unsustainable in such a situation.
Right. Mina, let me ask you a similar question. So Russia invades Ukraine, and Finland, which does have a very long land border with Russia, has a very similar reaction to Sweden. How did Russia's invasion of Ukraine affect Finnish security perceptions?
I think that was the final red line that Russia crossed when it comes to Finland. As Katarina already mentioned, this development of growing Russian aggression in the region, or assertiveness and aggressiveness, has been observed already since 2014. It became clear already, as also Katarina already mentioned, 2008, basically, that Russia is very willing to do as it pleases with its neighborhood, and it doesn't necessarily respect borders and international treaties and law. So what happened now was it was the final trigger for which really made it absolutely clear that no amount of self-restriction when it comes to security policy or alliances will guarantee security anymore in Russia's neighborhood. So basically, Finland had already had since the 90s this so-called NATO policy, keeping the option to join open, and had also pursued a closest possible cooperation level with NATO, just like Sweden as well. But without applying for the full membership, and this was full-scale invasion of Ukraine, absolutely unprovoked and absolutely illegal in terms of international law. That was definitely the red line that Russia finally crossed. Made Finland to play this NATO card.
Let's dig down on what you mentioned there a bit, and I'll turn back to you, Katarina, first for the Swedish side. During the past several years, and perhaps even longer, one of the less appreciated aspects of Swedish defense policy has been the fact that in very practical ways in developing military systems and equipment, it has been prepared to cooperate extensively with NATO members, even if not a formal NATO member, but certainly it makes NATO membership easier in terms of interoperability of military systems and equipment. Talk through that a little bit. Most people don't understand well Sweden's domestic arms production and the kinds of systems it produces. So talk through that and explain how Sweden is so prepared now to integrate fully with NATO systems and procedures.
So yes, I listened earlier today to a previous podcast episode that you had here on Sweden's and Finland's decision to join NATO or apply for NATO membership. And mm-hmm. some of this was mentioned. And I think one important aspect to understand here is sort of how history looked in Sweden for the past decades. Sweden is often wrongly labeled as neutral until now. In fact, we were neutral until the early 1990s when we decided to apply for EU membership. And since, the official doctrine has been military non-alignment. And one cornerstone of this military non-alignment and the previous neutrality was that we should have a defense capability of our own that was strong enough to sort of defend ourselves in case of a crisis or a conflict. This was the official doctrine. But the underlying doctrine, which was not much talked about openly, was that we had an extensive cooperation with the West already during the Cold War and with NATO countries, and not the least with the US. So there's a long history of cooperation there, even in the days of neutrality and the subsequent days of military non-alignment. And of course, since we already sort of knew where we belonged, even though it was not in our official doctrine, Sweden's well-developed and extensive military industry complex was sort of tilted towards the West and towards NATO countries. And since then, the cooperation with NATO countries and with the US have just grown closer and closer. And we, for the past years, have also had open exercises and been an official partner of NATO. And the closer sort of the cooperation began, the closer also the systems, the military systems, became more compatible and interoperable with each other. So therefore, also, it's not a major step for Sweden's system to sort of plug into the NATO infrastructure as it is right now.
Right. Mina, similar question for Finland. What about the practical considerations of getting military systems and equipment to work with NATO in this new threat environment?
Yeah, that's been a long-term process in Finland as well. One Finnish analyst kind of as a joke said Finland had its own membership action plan process in the past 30 years, starting with the NATO Partnership for Peace in 1994. Then since 2014, Finland and Sweden both have been enhanced opportunity partners. By the way, Sweden joined the Partnership for Peace as well in 1994. And Finland has been actually one of the most active non-member countries to contribute to NATO missions, has been deliberately seeking this cooperation at the highest possible level to ensure this, what Katarina already mentioned, this highest possible interoperability, so that in case that joining becomes urgent, as it became now, that we can do it. From our side, there won't be the need for a lengthy process of bringing our armed forces to a compatible state with NATO. So Finland has been working on this for a long time already through joint exercises with NATO countries and also in the procurement decisions. This has been considered in the past 20 years to try to buy or procure equipment that is as highly compatible as possible with NATO standards. We see this the latest decision, for example, before any of this membership perspective that will happen this year became evident. Last December, the Finnish government decided to buy 64 F-35 fighter jets. So this was quite a remarkable decision, and if you combine it with the F-35s that also Denmark and Norway will have or will get from the United States in the coming years in this decade, this will make up quite a remarkable fleet of F-35s in the Nordic region, and of course not to forget the Swedish Gripen fighter jets as well. So these are just some examples of the deliberate building of interoperability. And I could maybe also note that since the NATO membership application, Finland has added 8 completely new military exercises this year only with NATO partners. And 12 more had already been planned, but have been slightly modified or so on. So this will bring the Finnish armed forces even closer to NATO cooperation and standards. So this will be a final step of that process.
That is wonderful detail. And Katarina, I'm hoping you can do a similar detail for the Swedish side in terms of which aspects of military hardware are the Swedes really well prepared for because of what you described as the long period of planning on largely self-defense in terms of either aircraft, in terms of the Navy? What is it that Sweden has emphasized in its military development, and what is it that the cooperation with NATO will really bring forward as an asset?
Well, Sweden, in a certain way, is the odd one out here. Like Mina mentioned, Sweden has a Gripen. We have our own fighter jets that we produce, and it's also been a bit of a sensitive issue with Finland lately, to be honest, since Saab and Gripen was very much open. Saab and Sweden was very much open for Finland to buy Gripen airplanes, of course, but. Even though we have a different system for fighter jets, the interoperability has already been there.
Right.
And it's been developed through decades, as I mentioned. And from a military standpoint, it can actually be seen as an advantage also to have different systems for an opponent to plan for, so to say. But Sweden, besides bringing a large air force to the table, so to say, from the naval perspective, Sweden has submarines and is the sole provider of submarines in the region. Also, Germany provides it, but that's sort of has been seen as a strategic advantage that it can bring to NATO also.
Thank you.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me. And it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back, and then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20.
I'd like to talk about some specific geopolitical issues in the Baltic. And both of them have to do with Russia and potential conflict scenarios with Russia. Mina, one of the issues, of course, and this goes back a long time for Russian leaders, is concerns about St. Petersburg, previously Leningrad, previously St. Petersburg, but St. Petersburg and its access to the open waters of the Baltic and then onward to the Atlantic Ocean. And the access is actually quite limited if Estonia and Finland cooperate in terms of batteries along the shoreline, because west of Helsinki, you have the narrowing of the Gulf there, and you could actually, in a sense, try to bottleneck Russian ships in a case of a war or a conflict scenario. Talk a little bit about that, about how Finland, in a very practical sense, has some Russian security planners concerned because of its very geography.
Yes, that's absolutely right. The Gulf of Finland is actually very narrow between Tallinn and Helsinki. It takes only a couple of hours to cross it with a ferry. So that is obviously an aspect that will make Russian military planners somewhat nervous. But here, Kaliningrad, the Russian enclave, not far away from the Swedish island Gotland, comes into play, and I'm sure we're gonna go into that as well. But for example, the Russian Baltic fleet has its main base in Kaliningrad, and that's exactly what makes Kaliningrad so strategically important for Russia, because in this kind of case that Finland and Estonia would limit the bottleneck the Russian movements from St. Petersburg, of course, in terms of military, Kaliningrad is very essential. But you're right, it still leaves open the question how Russia would then figure out the transit from St. Petersburg, from the harbor. But honestly, in normal times, as far as we can call these times normal at all, but even with Finland in NATO, I think that the main interest of all actors in the Baltic Sea region will be to avoid any kind of escalation. And I think that Russia is quite aware of the changed strategic situation in the Baltic Sea region now that Finland and Sweden will join NATO, and of that kind of limitations to its room for maneuver. And that is basically exactly the point also why Finland and Sweden are joining, because Russia has been quite assertive and quite aggressive as well in the Baltic Sea region. Just to mention six amphibious warships that that were brought into the Baltic Sea back in January, in the process of building up the troops at the Ukrainian border. They came from Murmansk to the Kaliningrad base, and all that kind of stuff. So Finland and Sweden see this move to join NATO as a stabilizing factor in the Baltic Sea security architecture, because it streamlines the defense planning of the whole region. And Russia's actions have not been developing into this negative direction only since this year. It's been a long-term process. In the past years, there was already this observation, and it also was considered in the defense strategies and security analysis of the both countries that the security situation of the Baltic Sea region had definitely deteriorated because of Russia's actions. So yes, that is a very important point, and it is kind of also to show Russia that there are limits to its actions here, and that it can't go rogue in the region. Mm-hmm.
I appreciate your context on Kaliningrad as well, because it is not just about the St. Petersburg access, but the Baltic access of the Kaliningrad. I don't know whether technically it's an exclave, but it is a outlier certainly there, because no direct land access to the main territory of Russia. You have to go through Lithuania or alternatively through Poland and Belarus to get from Kaliningrad on land to Russia. But of course, with the sea access, and the Russians have put quite a bit there. So that does raise, Katerina, the question of Gotland, because in the Baltic Sea, you do have a nearly central position of the largest island that is wholly within the Baltic Sea, Gotland, a Swedish island. Now, as Minna pointed out, it's not that there are Finnish or Swedish or NATO plans to do this kind of blockade, but the Russians fear it enough that there have been scenarios drawn up, including in fiction by best-selling author Brad Thor, who I talked to recently on our sister podcast, Chatter, whereby Russian operatives actually try to take over that island, Gotland, in the Baltic Sea in order to prevent NATO forces from moving eastward. Talk a little bit about the strategic placement of Gotland, but also the strategic issues involving the narrow channel between Sweden and Denmark exiting the Baltic and getting out into the Atlantic Ocean, the North Sea, and then the Atlantic Ocean. Well, Swedish defense planners have a lot to think about when it comes to potential scenarios with Russia, don't they?
Indeed, they do. And so do the Finnish ones. But I think that it's interesting with Gotland how this not small island, but small when it comes to population, has become so central, not only now in a Nordic-Baltic security context, but also in a NATO security context. And the reason for that, of course, is, as you pointed out, David, that it's, if you look at a map, it's almost right in the middle of the Baltic Sea. And it has been described as the one who controls Gotland controls the Baltic Sea region. Placing equipment on Gotland and placing military systems on Gotland can, in fact, sort of block access to military help to the Baltic countries, not at least. So therefore, the country's strategic importance has become so highlighted lately. And in the beginning of this current conflict, as Minna pointed out, and the entrance of the six amphibious warships into the Baltic, an example of the strategic importance of Gotland could be seen there, as the Swedish military decided to enhance the presence on Gotland heavily in connection to this entrance of the amphibious warships. So that was just one of the latest examples of how strategically important this island is.
Yes, if I may add to that, it was observed in Finland, like, whoa, okay, like even Sweden, like now puts tanks on Gotland, so something's definitely up. Like if even Sweden goes that far, then that's definitely a sign of something brewing.
Yes. And just to give a historic perspective, I mean, Gotland during the Cold War was seen and treated in military planning as the strategically important island that it actually is. But then as Sweden's defense policy changed and military cutdowns were introduced subsequently, also the military presence on Gotland was cut down significantly and in the end abolished for 2 decades. And then after 2014 and Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea, the military presence on Gotland was reestablished again. And of course, now, once again, Gotland is in the focus of not only Nordic Baltic security, but also in a wider NATO context.
Mm-hmm. We've talked separately on the podcast with Rachel Rizzo and Nick Danforth in the United States about overall NATO dynamics involving Turkey's, I don't know what to call it, obstinance in regarding the invitation to Sweden and Finland into the alliance. But I wanted to get drill down on the Swedish and Finnish perspectives on that. So from what it looks like, Turkey was not opposed to NATO membership for Sweden or Finland on general concerns. They weren't worried about Article 5 commitments to Sweden and Finland. It was merely a domestic political play of trying to ensure that their concerns about Kurdish-related terrorists were taken seriously by Stockholm and Helsinki. And so they did come out with a trilateral memorandum that described the firm commitment of Sweden and Finland to crack down on no kidding terrorism and terrorism financing and things of that sort. But it did not technically require anything that Stockholm and Helsinki were not already doing. There is some concern, however, that because as of the time of this recording, we're getting close to half of the members of NATO that have ratified within their countries and their own political procedures that have ratified the NATO membership of Sweden and Finland. There is some concern that Turkey, which has not done so yet, may raise objections again and use that memorandum as an excuse in the coming weeks to wave it in the faces of Swedish and Finnish diplomats and say, look, you said you would take this seriously, but we haven't seen the action we're expecting. So first to you, Mina, but then Katarina, please weigh in after that. How seriously do you take the threat of Turkish troublemaking in this regard? And do you think that it is going to be any obstacle from the Finnish side and then the Swedish side?
Well, actually, since the issue could be, or it was solved like surprisingly quickly already ahead of the Madrid summit, I had actually expected it to maybe drag on a bit more. Although I did think that the, you know, this physical meeting and the pressure created by like being confronted with your 29 allies who are all like in favor of Finland and Sweden joining, or at least no one else objects and some are like outright enthusiastic about it, that could move Turkey already. But honestly, I think that this memorandum of understanding was actually quite an elegant diplomatic solution to the problem that Turkey created, because the language is vague enough not to oblige Finland and Sweden to actually change any like practices or laws or policies in that sense. But it was also it entailed all the right words and concepts for Erdogan to kind of like present it as a win domestically. There have been concerns and a lot of criticism on it, but I thought that it was a little bit maybe a little bit of an overreaction. It has been emphasized in Finland by the state leadership, by both the president and the foreign minister, that it was exactly the point of the memorandum that like everyone can like that Sweden and Finland don't really have to, you know, change anything, but Turkey also can get something, and that it's kind of a win-win. And since actually, like, even after signing that, Erdogan still could have maybe like postponed signing the accession protocols, but he didn't. He was basically instantly on board with that, and that would have been like a further maybe like possibility to really unilaterally further block the process. And I think that because of this extraordinary pace of ratifications that we have been seeing until now, so many countries actually like expediting the procedure so that they can still make it before the summer recess and all that. And there was actually this kind of like really cute and fun like competition between the Nordics and Baltics and Canada, and like Canada and Denmark had a little diplomatic dispute which one was in the end like first to ratify. So I think this is quite unprecedented and extraordinary, and this will, like, if it goes on like this and let's say that most NATO members have ratified Finland and Sweden, maybe even all of the others have ratified the two countries until, let's say, end of this year, and it's only Turkey kind of pending, I don't think that Turkey will have, again, that kind of like really strong position to like postpone it for like some unreasonable time. So I'm fairly confident right now. It is like in Finland, there's this mood that like nobody is going to open any champagne bottles before like all 30 countries have ratified, because there is certainly this idea that we can expect some more hiccups, and exactly what you said, David, that like Turkey will probably come and waive this memorandum of understanding in the faces of Finland and Sweden and so on. So that is certainly expected, but honestly, I am like fairly confident that Erdogan got what he wanted at the Madrid summit, and that there will maybe be some more drama, but that there won't be any like substantial problems anymore at this point.
I must say, this is a very serious topic and a very serious issue, but I have enjoyed, Mina, on Twitter, watching you with the race to ratification as each country tried to get their papers in, because according to the North American treaty, what happens is the countries ratify by their own political process for ratifying treaties, and it must be deposited with the office of NATO inside the United States State Department in Washington. So you must have the action taken in each country, but then the communication and the actual handing off to the proper official in the U.S. State Department. And it was kind of fun for a few days to watch the countries that raced to do it and within minutes were trying to become the first or the second or the fifth country to do it. And now as the time we're recording this, we're over a third of the countries of NATO, approaching half, and we'll see where we go with it. Katarina, what was the Swedish perspective on the Turkish shenanigans?
Well, it was a bit of an anti-climax, wasn't it? Because we had a historic process here of our own, with the historic change in public opinion and the NATO application signed and handed in by a social democrat government, which was historic indeed, since they have been against NATO membership forever. Yeah. So it was indeed an anti-climax. We almost opened our champagnes already. But of course, the general response has been positive to what happened in Madrid and to the memorandum of understanding that was signed. I share what Mina said here with sort of a hopeful optimism here, but Mina said that there's a general perception to not open the champagne yet in Helsinki. The Brits have an expression that says it isn't over until the fat lady sings, and that's more my concern at this moment. Actually, I am not sure that we have seen the end of this yet. Turkey has dragged on processes in NATO before, not the least blocking the Danish the former Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen for a long period of time. So it has a history of sort of dragging on these processes. And since the memorandum of understanding was signed a couple of weeks ago, we have heard again sort of Turkish concerns being raised. And I think this is more an issue with Sweden than with Finland, which sort of reflects the situation in Sweden with a large Kurdish diaspora that is politically active, at the least. So I think this is more sort of signaling towards Sweden. And it is possible that it will continue throughout the fall, at least until the elections in Turkey.
If I may come in real quick about what you just said, Katarina, that's actually one thing that will be interesting to see, because now, you know, it's not anymore up to Finland and Sweden which countries ratify when. And obviously for most countries, it will be in their interest to ratify both at once. But it will be also interesting to see whether Turkey will, for example, ratify just Finland and not Sweden. Or something like that. Like there are still definitely like possibilities of further hiccups in this process from that side.
I think so, and there have been some statements in the media for the past few weeks, and I think the issue that is most sensitive is the one about extraditions from Sweden, and that will be sort of the one that is raised the most by Erdogan and in Turkey.
I assume, Katarina, that there is no political appetite in Sweden towards changing its view of extradition in order to placate Turkey simply for the sake of easing ratification.
No, and that would be against several, against the asylum process and against the pretty fundamental laws in our view of the of democracy. So there is not an appetite for that. I don't believe it will happen either. But it's also a sensitive issue since, I mean, if NATO was a sensitive issue politically 6 months ago, the main argument that was raised against NATO membership here in Sweden by its opponents was sort of, we will not let Turkey dictate our foreign policy. That was, of course, never true, but it was still sort of an issue that was raised. And now if it is apprehended as sort of us handing over too much to Turkey in this process, it will become sensitive again. So I agree with what Mina said, that the memorandum was very elegantly formulated, but it's does not necessarily mean that the process will continue in this way. Turkey still has to ratify our application.
Right.
And we're not there yet.
Well, let's close the conversation by moving from political obstacles to potential military risks. Mina, first, what risks could arise in this delicate period between the NATO invitation and actual NATO membership, because it almost certainly will be months, possibly the end of this year, possibly early next year before full ratification takes place. What steps is Finland taking in order to minimize this risk and to make clear to Russia, just in case Russia is truly out of control, that it is not a good idea to try anything simply because Finland is not a member of NATO yet?
Well, Finland has been basically like preparing for all eventualities. We have had these ideas what could happen, like and which happened so far, which doesn't mean, of course, that they can't still happen at a later point. But basically what we expected to happen would have been this usual, like, let's say, Russian repertoire, like airspace violations, cyber attacks, maybe some also like, you know, cruising too close to the Finnish borders in the Gulf of Finland, or also there were some scenarios that the Finnish Defense Forces had prepared for, kind of like deliberate accidents happening somewhere, like let's say somewhere in Lapland in Finnish territory, a Russian plane has an accident and lands lands in the Finnish territory. And then because there's something sensitive on board, then there will be like Russian like support troops coming there, and they block access for Finnish forces, and this kind of situation where kind of like what we imagine, or that similar situations could be imagined in the Åland Islands, which are between Finland and Sweden, and also kind of like in a strategic position, especially because they have a demilitarized status. So all of these things were like totally on the Finnish radar, and Finland was kind of like counting or expecting something like this to happen. And so far, nothing has happened. It looks like Russia is so tied up in Ukraine that it hasn't, it just doesn't have the capacities to do anything, especially military, right, against Finland. And what is very interesting, when you consider the Russian threat tradition against Finnish and Swedish NATO membership, for example, the Kremlin has been issuing the threat of like putting troops to the Finnish border, or like building up troops at the Finnish border in case Finland joins NATO, because then they will see us as an enemy and so on, like since at least 2016. But what has happened now since Finland applied for NATO membership is that Russia has been actually pulling troops away from the bases close to Finnish border. Just last week, it was reported that according to some satellite pictures, there is one military base which is quite significant. It's in Lapland, quite close to the Finnish border, and it was only established in 2014, and it is specialized in Arctic warfare, this kind of motorized brigade. So even there, like that was the last one now to also have sent, like where also now equipment has been pulled away, and you then assume that also people have been pulled away. It looks like there's like at least a battalion that has been that is missing now at that base. So it just like kind of indicates that Finland is in the end actually quite a low priority for Russia, even with NATO membership happening. So I think that actually the situation is not at all as dire as expected, because Russia is simply too occupied in Ukraine. And even if Russia at some point decides that, like, okay, this Finnish NATO membership does warrant a stronger Russian military presence in the border region, it will take them years to redevelop that, right, to any kind of level that can like seriously threaten Finnish defense forces.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
And Russia has also, Katerina, been doing some aggressive air maneuvers near, and I believe even in, Swedish airspace. So some of the same concerns may come up. What are the risks that Swedish defense planners are seeing during this period before full NATO membership?
Yes, as you mentioned, there have been aggressive moves. There have been airspace violations since February 24th. The last one, I believe, was in April. But this is actually not new, because we have seen Russian airspace violations of Swedish airspace prior to February 24th. As well, and they have intensified significantly over the past 10 years, on and off in different periods, I would say. But I think the overall impression is pretty much the same here as in Finland, and similar to what Mina mentioned. I mean, Russia is indeed held up in Ukraine, not entirely though. I mean, the Baltic Sea Fleet is still there and not being used. So in a way, you could say that they have the capacity and the capability, but not the appetite to do something in the Nordic Baltic region. And that is, of course, due to the situation of overreach that they have put themselves in with the operation in Ukraine. I think that we expected more, similar to what Mina said, in Sweden. I mean, after February 24th, there's really been a high sense of urgency amongst the population and Swedish readiness has sort of never been higher, at least not in my lifetime. And I think that it's a positive sign that we can sort of mobilize and understand the sense of urgency. There is a major war in our not far from Sweden going on. But when it comes to actions that are directed directly towards us, we so far haven't seen that much. I mean, there have been some cyber attacks that I guess one could attribute to Russia, that's the problem with cyber attacks in general, but not any major ones. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to airspace violations, I believe it was just that one that has been reported. Mm-hmm. But it was more prior to what happened in Ukraine with the amphibious warships, as Mina mentioned, for instance.
Well, thank you both for joining us on the Lawfare podcast. I have a feeling we'll be revisiting these issues certainly around the time of full NATO membership and beyond.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Remember, you can get ad-free versions of this and some other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. Please remember to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts, and do listen to our other podcast products like Rational Security, Chatter, The Aftermath, Allies, and Lawfare No Bull. This podcast was edited and engineered by the overworked Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.